Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. And you're listening to The Mark Steiner Show right here on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Last weekend, I moderated a panel at Everyman Theater in Baltimore. It was part of the World of the Play series called Waiting in the Wings. This conversation was inspired by Everyman's current performance, The Understudy, and looked at what it really takes to be an understudy, what their life is really like. Joining the conversation were Rebecca LaChance, a current Broadway understudy for the role of Carol King in Beautiful, Kyle Prue, Everyman Theater's director of production and casting. He himself was an understudy earlier in his life. And Joe Smeltzer, Shakespeare Theater Company's resident production stage manager. Let me start with Rebecca, because Rebecca is in the heat of all this, so to speak. And I want to, the things that you said to me when we were going back and forth by email, you talked about just that what it means being understudy as an actor and how things, what it's like to have to be called at the last second, to leap on stage, not knowing what you're doing, and describing what that sense of being is.
Basically, the journey of an understudy changed from the beginning of the show towards where I am now and a year in. So the first time that I ever went on for Carol was over almost a year ago now in San Francisco, and it was our final performance of our tryout performance, our tryout run in San Francisco. We had all just become very used to the show. I'm an onstage cover, which means that I'm in the ensemble in the show every night. And in addition to that, I cover the roles of Carol and Cynthia. And so I had gotten very used to my regular track. We're like ready to go home. Everybody's getting settled in. And then we were surprised with illness. And I ended up having to go on with an hour's notice and no rehearsal, which is obviously not ideal for anyone, but turned out to work for us. But now that I'm a year into the show, we have understudy rehearsal almost every week. And now when I just finished a week's worth of performances as Carol because Jesse Mueller was on vacation. Now I'm utterly prepared for it. So the understudy can have any different kind of call. You know, now I'm like, okay, I can do it anytime, anywhere, doesn't matter how much notice I have. But at that first time, it was a complete surprise.
So when we watch the play here, most people in this audience have seen the play, the understudy here that's now as Everyman. And it takes place in the understudy rehearsal. So, right? And so I'm curious, from all your perspectives, let me start with you again, Rebecca, and then run down the line here. What is understudy rehearsal really like?
I was actually really surprised by understudy rehearsal. I expected it to be like everyone is there and we all just get to practice being our understudy roles, but it's actually the most bare bones rehearsal you can possibly have. Like, Therese Rebeck gets it exactly right. It's like you and the stage manager and maybe lights and maybe set, but not even necessarily. And you're learning the blocking. You're supposed to just already know the lines. Like, you have to just know them. You can maybe call line if you know, but it's you have everything and you're basically just being told where to stand, what the other actors are expecting of you.
I can talk about it from a kind of both sides. I've actually understudied several times, had to go on as an understudy several times. Fortunately, a few times in very difficult roles have not had to go on. And that would, as an understudy, always be my preference, is to not have to go on. When you see the level of the work you're trying to recreate, it's a daunting task to say, I'm going to step in with this whole group of actors who've been doing this for weeks, months, years possibly. My first experience ever going on as an understudy, I had understudy rehearsals with the stage manager and the other understudies, but I went in and at 6:30 in the evening and met all the other cast members, Angela Bassett and Delroy Lindo and a group of, at the time they weren't well-known actors, but this was at Arena Stage 20 some odd years ago. I said, hi, nice to meet you. Hi, nice to meet you. Hi, nice to meet you. Got to run through my scenes for about 20 minutes. And then I'm sharing a dressing room with these people as if I'd been doing it, and off we go. It is surreal. My experience of the rehearsals as an understudy, they are all different. In that case, they knew that I was going to go on at some point. So in the understudy rehearsals, the stage manager always was very nice and said, went through my stuff multiple times, and the other understudies got one crack at me because they knew that I was going to go on at some point. That's not always the case, and I've, like Rebecca was just saying, I've gone on with no rehearsal before, knowing the lines, knowing the blocking. Fortunately, when I've had to do that, I knew the other actors, so there was a sense of, hi, how are you? We knew each other, at least. Here we go. Give each other a hug, and the lights come up, and then off you go. But you don't remember much about it if you only go on once, because you're totally going on adrenaline. And I find afterward, it's over now. Only one time as an understudy have I gone on multiple times, and I really appreciated that, because by about the fifth or sixth time, I was like, oh, okay, I feel like I'm actually sort of acting now a little bit.
Joe.
Just in terms of thinking about rehearsals, my entire career has been in regional theater. So nonprofit, many of them about, I'm with Shakespeare Theater now. I was with Seattle Rep for a number of years and American Conservatory Theater. So higher end regional theaters where we have always had understudies. We have 5 understudy rehearsals. They're each 5 hours long. The first 4 of them are done with some rehearsal costumes, some props, no movement of the set, no lights, and sound possibly run after my personal laptop hooked up to a speaker so that I sit there and you can sort of hear what it sounds like, but not really in any sense of reality. The 5th is when we add the crew in so we can actually move the set. So one of the challenges is, if you're doing a show, this is a decent example, there are about 4 different looks of the set. In terms of the walls moving and the wagons moving. The first 4 of those rehearsals we would do probably on a bare stage because we don't have anyone there to move the set for us and we can't actually do it ourselves. So maybe we grip a table out, which would normally come out on a wagon. But it's a very sparse representation. At ACT, we worked in a room about this size for all of the understudy rehearsals. I never had an onstage understudy rehearsal the last time I was there. So I would just drag all the props up to the room and we'd sort of like set up chairs to mimic the walls. And you really just sort of go through the motions really more than anything else. The other major challenge is when you have swing understudies. So Shakespeare Theater, we often have big ensembles. Last year we did a production of Henry IV, parts 1 and 2, which we ran in rep. And I had an ensemble of about 12, and I had 3 men covering all 12 positions. So each man is really needs to know between 3 and 5 tracks, depending on what they're doing. And when you're rehearsing it, you've only got those 4 or 5 people. You don't have all 12. So you do it once with 3 people standing in for 8 people, and then you go back and do it again, and they all play a different part and walk a different part, but there's still not enough. So maybe I've got an assistant and an intern who are helping move the table because that's what actually has to happen in this moment. But it always feels very piecemeal. And you basically try and create as much as you possibly can the reality of the situation. You try and give the understudies a sense of this is the path that you will walk and this is the prop that you're going to pick up. But they're doing it in a void, because you don't have the costumes, you don't have the lights, you don't have the other actors in the room. It's a very unique situation. And I actually was here with a friend of mine, Julia Brandeberry, who's a local actress, and she was in the production I did last year and also went on as an understudy. And I was talking to her about this experience. And she mentioned to me that the only time that she actually ran the role that she was going to perform without jumping back and forth between another part was the put-in rehearsal we had at 1:15 p.m. for a 2 o'clock performance.
Yeah.
So, yeah, sound familiar? So we had done 5 understudy rehearsals, but she always bounced back and forth between Doll Tearsheet, which is the role she ended up playing, and Mistress Quickly. And if Mistress Quickly was having the lines, even if Doll was on stage, she'd jump over and be Mistress Quickly, and then she'd go back and be Doll again. So the first time she actually got to do it straight through was with Stacey Keach on a 10-minute rehearsal for a 7-minute scene that happened at 1:15 before we then did Fight Call at 1:25, opened the house at 1:35, and did the performance at 2 o'clock. And she had never tried on the costume. she had never, like, we actually did have to change some blocking because she sat on Stacey's lap and she was about 10 inches taller than the actress who normally played it. So all of a sudden you couldn't see Stacey for the whole scene. So we're making like really quick adjustments in that 10 minutes that we have to do it. So, so rehearsal does take a lot of different forms. And actually one of the main things that I would argue with the show that we just saw today is they kept calling it a put-in rehearsal. It was not a put-in rehearsal. It was an understudy rehearsal. And the difference is an understudy rehearsal, you have the stage manager and the understudies. A put-in rehearsal, you have the company who's going to be performing with you and the one understudy who's going to perform on that day, and you have them walk through that part with the real people that they'll do it with tonight or this afternoon. And so that was a little bit, that was my one sort of semantic.
But it is oftentimes immediately before half hour, right before the actual
And depending on, you know, in this particular case, we had a death in the family that we knew the evening before. So I knew at about 6 o'clock the night before that she would be performing at 2 o'clock. So, you know, I popped into Stacey's dressing room and said, you want to run through the scene? He goes, yes, please. Let's do it at 1:15. I said, great. But that you're limited to, once you've opened, you're limited to 10 hours with the company, with the equity company, in terms of what you can actually use, the amount of time that you can use outside of the performances. So if I've already had two understudy rehearsals and I have to call a put-in rehearsal, I got to call my producer and ask for permission to have overtime for any of the equity members. And if they say no, then it means we're sending somebody on without having ever said the lines with the person that they're actually looking at in that particular scene.
Oof.
Which I'd say is more common. It is more common in my experience to not have a put-in rehearsal and to actually just drop somebody in with the rehearsals that you've had scheduled.
So, Rebecca, you're living at the moment. How does this all fit in with your reality?
That's actually, everyone spoken has been really accurate to what I've been experiencing. It's obviously a little bit different in regional theater than we have on Broadway, just because the timeline is completely open-ended for us. So there's no limit of only 5 rehearsals or, I mean, we do have a weekly limit because of Actors Equity in terms of rehearsal hours. But because we've been going now since November of last year on Broadway, we understudies are contracted to have so many hours a week. And we're not always called, like, you know, right now we're beginning to deal with cast turnover. So people's contracts are running up and we're getting new cast members. And, you know, that's switching up everything in terms of understudy rehearsal, because now new people have to learn entirely new tracks. And those of us who know ours are sort of like, okay, like, we're going to trust that you guys are good for a few weeks. And like, we'll see you once everything settles down, you know, and then it's sort of on us to make sure that we're still studying. And, you know, at some point, you know, studying kind of ends, you know. For my Carol track now, I know it well enough that I don't get concerned anymore. But Cynthia, the other track that I understudy, I have never gone on for her. So I definitely feel less comfortable in that. And like the girl who was the first understudy for Cynthia is on vacation right now. So there's still a chance that I might have to do it. And so it's like you're a little more on edge when, you know, it's something unknown to you, because that's the thing. I've never had a put in for Cynthia. I've never, like, I've only had a few understudy rehearsals for that, because they focus more so on, you know, your first cover track, which for me is Carol.
And you had a chance to play Carol in Chicago.
Yes,
and
I just did 8 performances in a row this week. I did a whole week while she was on vacation. And that I think brings me up to like about 20 performances total of the like 300 so that we have done.
It's exciting. And folks, you can go on her Facebook page, by the way, and watch some of these performances. She's amazing. Singing as Carol. You are amazing singing as Carol King. But now, every man doesn't have understudies, right?
That's right. We typically do not have them here at Everyman. At our level of regional theater, it's cost prohibitive for us to have them. And given the size of our audience, any one night, our maximum capacity is 253 people. It is more cost effective to add a performance later and to switch out audience members in the event of a death in the family, an illness that prevents going on, or something like that. We did quick calculations. We do this every year or two. Vinny, our artistic director, will say, put a couple hours into figuring out what would it cost. If we were to try to understudy our season with a combination of union and non-union understudies, we as an SPT are allowed to have so many non-union actors.
SPT meaning?
SPT is small professional theater, sorry, which is a contract with an Actors Equity. And there's a lot of wiggle room here, but it's somewhere between $125,000 and $175,000 to understudy a season. Because with an equity understudy, a union understudy, you're paying the same amount you're paying the union actor. So you're paying them the same that you're paying the actor who's actually doing the show every night. So those costs, clearly, they can add up very quickly. And, you know, as Joe can attest, the amount of work to rehearse those people and get them ready to perform, even if it's ready, at least they've walked the track a few times. Even that, there's big cost and there's limited number of hours before you get into, now we have to start paying overtime to all of these actors. So at our level, and it's something that many regional theaters around our size are in the same boat. And some the size of Shakespeare Theater have gone the route now of, we can't afford them. We can't afford to have them. I would love to have them. I would love financially if we could afford to have that in our season. Because it's, you know, it's going to happen. Someone is going to get sick. Someone is going to get ill. Someone's going to, transportation issues. We've had people miss. One of the times I've understudied and had to go on, I understudied as a favor to a producer I knew, knowing I would never have to go on. The actor who was playing the role was a dear friend, and I said to him, Danny, I said, Danny, don't miss. It was a 45 or 35 minute monologue. I said, do not. I said, I don't ever want to do this, please. And I got a call. This was at the Kennedy Center in Washington, and it was a theater for young audiences. And I got a call from a stage manager at 6:15 in the morning. It was a 9:30 show saying, well, Danny went to New York to get new headshots, and he missed his train this morning. And I was, so she said, you're going on at 9:30. Come on in. And, well, it was a 35 or 40-minute monologue when Danny did it. It was about a 25-minute monologue when I did it. I actually said all the words. He didn't always say all the words. I was just going on such adrenaline, and my pace was so fast that I ended up cutting about 10 minutes from the show just by going a lot faster. have you had that experience?
I cut 6 minutes out of the show the first time that I did it.
Absolutely. It's adrenaline fueled, to say the least. And you can't stop it. You can't stop it. The great thing about it is, and I'll let you talk about this too, Rebecca, is the camaraderie of the group of the cast around you is something that is, you know, there's always a camaraderie a cast develops. But when there's one new person up there, when there's an understudy up there, everybody who's been doing it every night for however long is in a different place. They're hearing it in a different way. Everyone's senses seem to be ratcheted up just a little bit. And the support you get, at least in my experience of it, is absolutely thrilling. I'll let you.
Yeah, please, Rebecca.
Yeah, it's incredible. Even up to now, it's still time because now, you know, we're in a place where this week we had, I think, one night, three of us who were playing principals were understudies, and a couple of swings were on as well. So, I mean, once you get further into a run, it's even crazier with juggling who's doing what every night. But the very first time that I went on, when it was, you know, no notice, no rehearsal, everyone just, it was like a force of nature. Like every single person in the theater, from stage management to our musicians, to the cast, to the crew members, to, you know, the poor sound engineer who was trying to figure out when I was going to speak and how loud I was going to speak and if I would remember to say the cue lines or... You know, all of it. And it was just everyone completely banded together to make that show happen. And as you were saying, it's so much adrenaline. Like the first time is 100% adrenaline. And that entire day is such a blur to me. I can remember like before the show crying with terror. And I can remember after the show crying that I couldn't believe I did it. And the middle part is very, very blurry.
I think that the difference between running a show with all understudies in the understudy rehearsal, yes, and running a show as an understudy performing a role with the rest of the cast is honestly like the difference between jumping into the deep end of the pool with absolutely no water and jumping into a full pool with like water wings and, you know, sort of everything. Because it, and it
it's
really
a great
is.
Analogy.
It's the amount of support. It's the oceans lifting all those boats up to a higher level, and watching a cast draw together around someone who I know what they did 3 days before in the understudy rehearsal, and I'm scared to have an audience actually pay to see this. And then you put them in with the company and they do a really beautiful performance. And it's partly the adrenaline, but it's also partly the fact that this is a communal experience. And when you only have to change out one element, the other 35, 40 elements that are in place really support that. And everyone rallies around an understudy. I've never seen an antagonistic understudy experience. It's always
and,
been
and in
supportive.
My experience, and I would love to hear when we get to open up to the audience here in a little bit of your own experiences, if you've ever seen an understudy performance. I've seen a couple as an audience member, and I find them absolutely thrilling. That energy is, it when I viewed it from the audience, is absolutely palpable to me.
As you were, before you said that, I was thinking that understudies are actors, professional actors, serious actors, who got a part, and you know, it's like there are so many people in the business of theater and music and other creative art forms who never get seen or heard, but are often just as good as the folks that you always see and hear. And so, as an understudy, this is your chance. As an actor, you get up there and boom, you've got it. You're there at that moment, and I mean that's why the performances are good, because you're not like underlings who don't know what they're doing. These are serious actors who are waiting in the wings, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, sometimes they're typically young. They're typically young actors. The one experience I mentioned before where I got to end up going on for six performances, I was saying to Nora before, something I've never understood about it. I was just out of college, and I was understudying a 55-year-old actor. And this was knowing, they knew when they offered me the job of understudying, you will get to perform it. We know you will. He had a film that he was going to do. They didn't know the exact dates, but they said, you will get to perform it. And they thought for a performance, ended up being for six or seven. It ended up, he got snowed in wherever he was filming, and I ended up doing it for close to a week. But I never quite understood. And even as a producer today, I kind of still shake my head and go, why would they have, you know, part of it is young actors say yes to anything. It's an
right,
opportunity.
Right.
Yes, of course I'll do it. In hindsight, I should have said, no, I'm completely wrong. It's crazy. Why would you want me to do that? So oftentimes, the type is not quite right. But they're young actors. And as Mark, as you say, typically with some training under their belts. They're not utter neophytes. They may not have had the onstage experience, but typically they've studied and worked and have a sense of what it is they're doing. It's also not the same as acting. Understudying isn't. Believe it or not, because you're not really making any choices. You're making the choices the person made who created the role, so as not to screw up all the other actors on the stage. You can't really make it. You may make a very different choice had you created the role, but you have to be faithful to the choices the actor who's playing the role made. If just for the sake of, you know, not totally screwing up the rest of your company, you know. So in that regard, it's a unique, different experience from actually creating a role.
I'd also say that, I mean, in addition to they're often young, mm-hmm. the younger actors are significantly better understudies.
Yes.
And I've worked with some really, really, really good seasoned actors who are terrible understudies. And, I mean, it's an interesting process. I actually have said, I give a little spiel to my understudies at the first rehearsal, and I truly believe it is the hardest job in theater to be an understudy. And part of the reason for that is that you don't get any of the process that everyone else gets, but you're expected to turn in the same product. So for an actor who is quite seasoned, and I've got two or three experiences of my own in this particular regard, the way they learn their part is not going home and memorizing. They'll do enough memorizing to get by in the rehearsal room so that they don't hold up the process. But the repetition within the room is where it actually drops into the bones and where you learn it. So they've lost the ability to go home and memorize, 2-hour play without the actual physical experience of repeating it in the room. And on a normal experience, you'll come back to a scene every 4 to 5 days. So you'll do it for maybe 3-4 hours. It'll sink in. They'll go home and do a little bit of work on it. You'll come back to it 5 days later. It's a little bit more in their bones, so that by the time you get to the preview process, you've been saying the same lines over and over again in the rehearsal room for 5 weeks. An understudy walks in and watches somebody else say those lines for 10 days and then is expected to be able to get up and do it and hit the same emotional marks and hit the same physical marks. It's a really, really hard job. And more than once, I've had a very, very good actor who I've worked with as a lead, and basically above the title type of lead, who can't memorize their lines as an understudy. And I had one position at American Conservatory Theater after the 4th understudy rehearsal with an actor who I'd known for years and grew up watching and revering. I had to go to my artistic director and say, he can't do it. I'm fully convinced that he is trying as hard as he possibly can, but we're either sending him on with book or you better hope he doesn't go on, because he can't learn the lines. And it's really interesting, and I think it's a wake-up call for a lot of actors too, because yes, he hadn't taken an understudy job in 20 years.
Rebecca, I want to bring you back in, because I, as someone in the midst of this now, both you were saying, commenting what you both heard Joe and Kyle say, I really think about what Kyle was saying about how an actor has this sense of what a role should be, even if you are the understudy, what you would love to see to do with it, but you can't. So, I mean, how does that...
I think that, for me, at least in this show, because Carol is like the title character, like everything happens to her and around her, and you almost never leave the stage except for to do really fast, quick changes. There is actually amazingly space in this show to actually get to act some as an understudy, which is very lucky for me, because there are certainly benchmarks that I have to hit in terms of, you know, you have to deliver some lines in a particular way to a particular person because that's what they need. That's what they have to receive every night in order to do what they're doing. But within, especially because there's a tremendous amount of singing that I do as Carol that is really unrelated to other people, I'm able to make vocal choices and, like, you know, change things a little bit. The way that I sound is different than the way that Jesse Mueller sings, and both of us sound different than the way Carol King sings. You know, it's like there's space inside of that for us to have different interpretations of this character, which is a real person. And for that, I'm very, very grateful. But what Joe was saying as well about, like, getting to lose the process entirely is also very true. So, for example, Carol has a Brooklyn accent, and I basically had to completely make it up. You know what I mean? Like, I basically, like, learned it from hearing Jesse do it and had, like, zero dialect work. They had, like, a coach and, like, rehearsals to do that. And none of us, no understudy gets that. You know, that's just, like, there's no time for that. So basically you're just like, okay, so like you can do that, right? And you're like, sure, I guess. Like,
you're not going to say no. You know? You're going to say yes, I can,
right?
Exactly.
I think it's also a perfect example of the fake it till you make it kind of idea.
Sure. Absolutely. And we also, like, one of the other skills that I have to have in the play is we have a piano that Carol is playing like almost the entire show. And fortunately for me, it's not actually the sound from the piano is not actually what the audience is hearing. They're hearing the conductor. But the audience can very much see your hands while you're playing piano in most of the numbers. So you have to look like you are conceivably playing what they're hearing. And so I have videos of our music director playing all the songs, and I would sit on the subway to and from work every day and practice, you know, like practice my fingering and make sure that it looked believable. And so for me, like, the most exciting thing is when friends or family comes to see the show and they're like, oh my God, I had no idea you played piano. Like, oh, thank God. You know, like, that's like the most amazing achievement to have. But, like, again, those are things that, like, you know, Jesse had piano lessons available to her and time in rehearsals to do those things, and me and the other understudy, none of that.
You're listening to the World of the Play panel discussion I moderated last weekend at Everyman Theater in conjunction with their performance of The Understudy. We're talking about the complex world of The Understudy and how it differs from acting. More of that illuminating conversation right after this break. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to The Mark Steiner Show on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Let's get right back to the World of the Play panel discussion I moderated last weekend at Everyman Theater in conjunction with their performance of The Understudy. This conversation is called Waiting in the Wings. We covered two other areas here before we open it up for you all to join in with your thoughts. I know you have burning questions here. Let me go back to something earlier and then come back to the artistic end. Something Kyle touched on and that Joe and I talked at length about on the telephone before we came here today, which was the world of The Understudy may be a world that doesn't exist as much in the future because of the cost factor. It changes. I mean, you can talk about how your theater decided to keep it and why Broadway has to have it, but it's a world that's changing. It's a world that everybody looked forward to as an actor. You know, the actors wanted to be an understudy because that was the way in, but this is a changing world.
It is ultimately understudying. The decision as to whether you're going to understudy shows or not is exactly the same decision as to whether you're going to buy an insurance policy, because that's really all that it is if an actor gets sick, if an actor, we have clauses that people can step out for bereavement leave and illness and all sorts of things that, you know, normal people take from vacation every day, but it doesn't impact the audience that's come seeing the show. So if one of those things happen and you don't have an understudy, then you decide, you know, as Kyle had mentioned earlier, do we cancel the show and reschedule it? Do we just reassign all those people to different seats? What is the cost of that versus what's the cost of running an understudy program? I was on the producing staff at Seattle Rep for 4 years. And in 2001, when we were hit really hard, shortly after 9/11, the economy in Seattle was hit very hard. And we had to cut our budget from $8.6 million to $6.8 million overnight to achieve the rest of the season. And one of the things that I was tasked with doing was figuring out what was the cost, basically the cost-benefit analysis of an understudy program. And back in 2001 at Seattle Rep, that cost was $85,000 for the season to understudy. What that meant was we would have had to cancel 5 completely sold-out houses in our 900-seat house and not be able to reseat any single one of those patrons before it actually cost us as much to not understudy as it did cost us to understudy. And ultimately, then the question becomes really one about PR, is are you willing to take the hit of calling all of your audience members and saying, we're canceling the show tonight and we're moving you? And that becomes really the only issue at stake, because we looked back on the number of times we'd sent understudies on in the past, and it absolutely in no way, shape, or form became anywhere near what the cost was. So we canceled the understudy program, and they still haven't reinstated it there. Shakespeare Theater, little bit different story. Last year, I mentioned the Henry IV reps that we did. Between the two parts, we did 88 performances, and I sent understudies on for 34 performances. Wow. There is no way that we could have canceled 34 performances and not lost significant face in the community and not lost all of our subscribers and single ticket buyers. And part of the difference is we're doing shows. That particular cast was 31 people. It was a 5.5-month contract. So the likelihood of somebody's grandmother dying, of someone's brother-in-law dying, both of which happened, of illness. I had illness go through our fellows' house. All of the ensemble I mentioned earlier were acting fellows. They were all living in the same house. And one by one, they went down for 2 days each in a row. So I had 12 days where I had people, different people out for 2 days, and then they got better, and the next person got sick, and then they got better, and the next person got sick. And it was like to the point where if we didn't have understudies, I couldn't have said, hey, come on, and you can still do it. It's okay. Like, they were out. And you also just don't want someone with a fever who's throwing up in the theater, passing it around to everybody else, because then it's just going to become a bigger cycle. Mm-hmm. But we also had fights. I had a 7.5-minute fight with 16 people with broadswords in Henry IV Part One, and musicals and big shows with fights You get people injured a lot. It's just the nature of dancing. Yeah. Oh. It's the nature of the business because we are asking people to do the same thing 8 times a week, very fast. And you get repetitive stress injuries. When we did Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum last year, every single one of my courtesans, I had 7 women in the chorus. Every single one of them was undergoing PT by the time we closed because you're asking them to do these extreme things over and over and over again. Vocal issues for singers. We had a situation with the fights last year where I had one actor who decided he wanted to add a little extra flourish as he was going off stage, and he was far away from anybody else. And he thought, oh, this will be totally fine. What he forgot was he had an axe on his belt, and he hit his pinky against the axe on his own costume and broke his finger and was out for 3 days, and then did the rest of the run with the cast on his finger. You know, and we say over and over again, don't add things. Don't add your flourishes. And he's like, it's fine. It'll be fun. And that was another situation where that was a matinee where he hurt himself. And I was like, look, dude, you got to go to the emergency room. He's like, I really don't want to miss the show tonight. I'm like, fine. You go to the emergency room. I'll be on the phone with you. At 7 o'clock, I make the call as to whether you're going on for tonight for a 7:30 performance. At 6:55, I get a text saying, he's clear, he's on his way home. So I say to everyone, you're good, it's all fine. At 7:05, I get a text for a 7:30 show saying, the doctor wants to see him some more. They think his finger's actually broken. So I tell the understudy, all right, now you're performing. You know, so, and that kind of thing happens fairly frequently. But when you have these bigger casts and longer runs, the likelihood of things coming up and having to cancel multiple shows is much higher. I've been at Shakespeare Theatre for 4 years. I can count on one hand the number of productions that I haven't sent understudies on. It is absolutely routine. But when you're doing a show with 4 people at the arena and it's a 4.5 or 5 week run, the likelihood of something happening when you don't have fights, you don't have dances, it's not a musical. It's just 4 people in a room and they're not likely to actually hurt each other and they'll probably not get sick and their probably mom won't die, but you're going to take that risk. The risk's significantly lower in that particular
case. And I
think
the capacity of the audience is the other issue. A 250-seat, what is the Harmon Center?
775.
That makes the math, skews the math as well. Reseating 775 to have to change a performance is a little trickier than 253 here at Everyman. So,
but we're also in a situation, as I was mentioning the other day, is that the economics are getting harder and harder for theater companies across the country. And it becomes more and more important that the money that is spent is going directly to what the audience is seeing on stage. And in our case at Shakespeare Theater, spending the money for the understudies, which is significantly more than the $85,000 that I mentioned for Seattle Rep, because we do have so many positions to understudy, that cost and making sure that the show can go on is obviously worth it. But in other places, if you're spending, you know, $125,000, that's a fairly significant portion of your budget.
Absolutely.
And it takes away from what you can put on the stage and the number of actors you can hire. And
yes,
it starts to play a role in programming,
yep,
too.
The scale of the shows you can afford to produce. Yeah.
For you, Rebecca, as an actor launching into her career, the role of an understudy for you and for many younger people like you, is critical. It's part of how you get seen and heard and known and respected and then can move into the next stage.
Absolutely. It's an incredible opportunity because basically someone is handing me the opportunity to be the star of the play. Like the thing you think, you know, my whole life I was like, I want to be on Broadway. And I was like, I'm going to do it. Holy cow. Like, it was such an amazing thing. This is my Broadway debut. And to be also given the opportunity to lead the show is exceptional. I mean, it's like something that does not happen to everyone and that I feel unbelievably grateful that it happened to me. But it's also like, it's an opportunity to, I invite casting directors when I go on, you know, like my agents come, we try and get creative director, you know, all different types of people to come and see me, because the hope is that you see me do this and you can trust me then to do other things in the future, you know. So as a networking sort of opportunity, it's huge. It's really, really great. And, you know, of course, my family and friends get to support me in this big role and it's all very exciting. But the sort of double-edged sword of it is that I also basically am like beginning every show that I go on, like, with a disappointed audience, with an audience of
right.
1,000 people who like bought tickets thinking that they were going to see the Tony Award winning Jessie Mueller. You know, like she, she is like, has been, she's incredible, let me say. But, you know, so much of our show's marketing has been about Bessie winning the Tony and how, you know, she tells the story of Carole King. And people walk in and they see my name on the board and they're like, oh, so just get her. You know, and it's just, it's the funniest thing. And fortunately, I've been very lucky and everyone seems to have been okay with it so far. And, you know, nobody's like out, you know, demanding their money back at the end of the show. But I'll get folks who come up to me at the stage door and, you know, they're like, okay, so we have to tell you, you know, we flew all the way from California and we were really upset when we heard that you were going on. And it's like, oh, okay, I'm so sorry to hear that. You know, like, what's going on? Like, what is the proper response to that? And then luckily they go on to, you know, compliment or, you know, say something nice, kind about my performance. But it's truly like, it's like, we're giving you this compliment, but we're also letting you know that we were not thrilled about it to begin with. And so like, it's this very strange thing. And then, you know, now today and yesterday, I'm like back into my role in the ensemble after doing a week of shows as Carole. And you leave the stage door and like nobody knows who you are and like nobody knows what part you played. And it's like this very bizarre, like self, like evaluating moment of like, right, okay. And now I'm back here again. And it's experiencing both of those feelings of like being the one that like everyone is so excited about. And then 2 days later, back to, you know, your little spot in the chorus. It's a strange thing.
Joe, you gonna say what?
There's a stipulation within the equity contract that if an understudy goes on, you have to do two of three things. Yeah. Post in the lobby, put a stuffer in the program, or make a live announcement. And when you have less time and you don't have all these stuffers pre-made because you don't know whether you're going to go on or not, I need about 3.5 hours notice in order to do the stuffing and the lobby posting. I push really, really, really hard with my front of house to get those things posted and stuffed, because I will tell you, like, oh, piggybacking on what Rebecca said, the worst sound in the world is to say, at this performance, the role of such and such will be played by such and such, and have 775 Wrong. People go, oh, you know, and here's the person in the wings, like, waiting to walk on, and your first thing before you perform is the disappointment of 1,000 people that they're going to have to watch you perform this role. Like, and already, this isn't the role that you rehearsed. So I personally feel like that's the worst possible place you could be as an actor. So I try and avoid that group response as much as possible.
Given the price of a Broadway ticket. Exactly. So, we have about 15 minutes left in our conversation, so we want to get some thoughts right here.
I'd like to know if you can think of the people who have been understudies who have gone on the basis of that performances to other types of events. Like people said, oh my gosh, we have to use him. Or any kind of success stories that you know of.
Good question.
I can speak to that. I don't know if you guys have something local.
No, please.
Go ahead, Rebecca.
But, Sutton Foster, who is now like a pretty big Broadway star, she was in Anything Goes, and she just was nominated for her performance in Violet this past season at the Tonys. But she sort of rose to her stardom that she, you know, has her Broadway stardom that she has now by being the understudy in Thoroughly Modern Millie years ago. And she was the understudy. And for some reason, the story, as far as I understand it, was that, towards the end of the tech product, you know, the tech portion of production and, getting closer to dress rehearsals and previews, the person who was playing Millie got sick and Sutton had to go on. And the producers were so thrilled by her performance. And I think just by her demeanor, I'm not sure, you know, this is maybe lore, but it seemed like the original Millie was perhaps not so wonderful to work with. And Sutton was such a dream when she came on and did it that they were like, no, this is yours, actually. We're going to move you up and this is going to be yours. And she went on to star in many Broadway shows after that.
Gentlemen?
I'd say regionally, it's a lot subtler than that. And you don't get the person who does some great lead role, and then everybody in town goes, oh my God, we have to hire them. Really, where I would say that it plays out is that the ensemble members, who are the people who are understudying the lead roles, are the real workhorses of the show. And they are doing their show every day, you know, as Rebecca said, in that sort of unrecognizable position and walking out anonymously through the stage door, but working twice as hard as everybody else because you're called in for understudy rehearsal. And what gets noticed in my side of the industry is the people who are working hard, and that I get my casting director to come and see the final run through. I report back and say, this person is fabulous. They knew everything. They were very prepared. They're wonderful to work with. And that gets them rehired on a smaller level than I'm now going to give you this great experience. But it's definitely noticed that that people work hard and carry their weight in that respect. It's also noticed when they don't.
So here's a question. When you have, obviously when you're moving up from the ensemble to being the star of a play, you have another person moving into the ensemble role, and you may have a number of people moving around, right? So that's one thing. The other thing I wanted to ask about was, the dynamic you were talking about, it being really scary to be an understudy and never having the role, never having played the role, and how that sort of intimidates all the people in the play. Is there also kind of a dynamic where people are given an opportunity to sort of, you know, in other words, if you're in like a Broadway play for a long time and you've been, you may, having that new person take on the role gives you a chance to do something a little different, and it's exciting, and, you know, like acting without without a net below you, is that also a dynamic that you see? So those two questions.
Great questions. Rebecca, why don't you start and then go to Kyle.
As far as who steps it, you're right, but you know, a lot of times things will start to really shift around when somebody goes up from the ensemble into a leading role. And then what we have in our show are swings, which are members of the ensemble that don't perform in the show every night. They're offstage swings. So they are there to cover multiple roles in the ensemble between two and six, depending on what roles you're covering in our show. In some shows, like Motown, I know in particular, I have a friend who's a swing on Motown, and he covers like 15 roles. I mean, a third the amount of things that you can have to cover depending on how large your show gets. But for us, what'll happen is we get an in-and-out sheet every night, and it says the folks that are on vacation or sick or whatever, those people are out, and the other folks in the company who will be filling in for those different roles. So sometimes it means one of the drifters is out. So we've got a swing on for the drifter, but a drifter who doesn't usually sing it is going to sing up on the roof. But, you know, I mean, it just, it changes every night. And that kind of dynamic is actually super exciting because it does give you room and space of something that you've been doing for the same year, for the same sort of way for a year, to change it up a little bit. And I mean, not a tremendous amount, because like I was talking about earlier, there are certain benchmarks that you have to hit along the way in order for the show to go on like it usually does. But you do have space to begin a new person and what they're giving to you, and maybe give them something a little different than you usually do to the other scene partner, as it were.
You talk about acting without a net. Yeah, it does have that feel. And one thing I want to point out, and I want to let you talk about this too, you don't, the backstage routine that the actor you're understudying goes through, when they exit, where they go, when they, the support you get as an understudy from the running crew of the show, literally, in my experiences of it, walking off stage, they take your hand, they say, come here, take this off, you're changing into that. That support is like the safety net, because you may probably have never worn this costume before. And the coordination it takes of the backstage people from their normal job. Normally, they don't escort the actor playing the role to their next thing. Do you want to talk about that preparation? Because
And we actually do ask actors to make run books and write down everything that they do mm-hmm. when they go off stage. Because in some cases, like, I go off, I take this coat off, I have to grab this prop, I run to the other side, they change my shoes, I put this thing on, and then I walk on, and all that was in 17 seconds. And if you get off, then you're in trouble. I've been lucky enough to, with the Henrys last year, I had a swinging assistant who would be doing something different each night. And if I had an understudy on, her job was to stand in the wings and literally take that understudy to their next thing and say, go in there, change your clothes, I'm taking you over here. Here's your sword. You're going to run across the stage now and go, ugh.
And push them on stage and now, even exactly. to that extreme of go.
Yeah. So that is, I would agree that that's where the net is.
Yeah.
And again, in all of the people on stage who, when you forget that line, they all know what it is and can figure out how to get you back on.
Yes, we can get you back on track.
We have another question here. Right here.
Are the understudies chosen because they have a physique and a physical resemblance to the person they'd be, substituting for? Because you change costumes, right? Yeah. But, you know, a size and a half can make a big difference. Shoes.
That is an excellent question. Our costume department sure wishes they were. In many cases, it's actually a really interesting thing to cast an understudy, because very, very often you're understudying more than one role. And you might not actually play either of those roles in real life because it's not exactly your type, but you're close enough to be able to cover either one of them. So you're hired for your versatility, but you don't actually look like either one of the two people that they're playing. So we have a big portion of our cost is in understudy costuming. And, I'd say on Broadway, you often have full costumes built for the understudies because they're not going to completely match and they'll have their own set. We try not to do that because it's a huge expense. But if we're building a show and we're building 80% of the costumes, if they don't fit into it, we either have to pull something or build something that looks like it. So very often people are hired for their ability to play multiple parts and their versatility as opposed to their look. And I'd say the only place where you really are going to diverge from that is if there is some reason that they really have to look a certain way. I mean, I'm assuming that all of the covers for Carol at least bear a passing resemblance to Carol King.
We're lucky in that because the budget is obviously bigger on Broadway, all of the understudies, we have a full set of costumes. So I never have to wear anybody else's costumes but my own. So I have a full set of Carol costumes. I have a full set of Cynthia costumes. I have my set of costumes. And then the swing who covers me and covers all those other people also has her own set of everything. So for us, there's no, I have to like squeeze into her jacket or whatever, you know, we're lucky in that way. But there are instances definitely where if someone is leaving the company, but the producers don't want to spend the money to have a complete new set of costumes made because it's incredibly expensive, particularly because most of our costumes are completely handmade. It's not store-bought items, you know? So in that case, sometimes producers will look for someone who is a very similar size so that the wardrobe can just alter their set of costumes and they don't actually have to go out and create an entirely new set. Because I have 3 wigs and like 10 costumes in my ensemble track. As Carol, there are 4 different wigs and like 15 costumes. So it's just a lot to have to duplicate again and again and again. You know, now they've got 2 sets of understudy and they'll probably keep those and alter them as long as the production runs.
I did a production of Doll's House a number of years back, and the woman who was hired to understudy Nora was hired specifically because she had the same body type as the woman playing Nora, and we were expecting she was going to have to go on, and there were very specific costumes, and we found out the day before tech she was pregnant with twins. So the corsets were off the table at that point, and when she did have to go on, we just sort of grabbed whatever we could find. We're like, just at least have her look like she's in the world, but we can't strap her into these corsets and send her out with the twins in there, you know. So sometimes you just do what you can.
I love it. We have time for one more question.
Well, this isn't really a question, but I just keep thinking, in The Dresser, the guy who played Fool, and the costume was like so many sizes too small, but that was obviously on purpose, and it was a comic thing, and plus he couldn't sing, and it just ended up that he was an understudy, but it was part of the play that he was not really quite right, but he was willing. So that was
director's choice. Absolutely right. It's a comic bit. Let's make believe that the role you're... We had 2 choices. He was either a giant, and so you come on stage in a costume that's way too big for you because you're going on that night. And Will Love, the actor who played the role, said, I think it would be better if he were really tiny and I were squeezed into a really tiny costume that didn't quite fit me. And so the costume designer and director thought that was a great idea as well, and that's where we ended up.
So here we are, the world of the understudy, waiting in the wings, and... first of all, I want to thank all of our panel here. This has been great. Rebecca LaChance, Tal Pruitt, Joe Smeltzer for joining us. For you all coming out for this premiere performance of Our World of the Play, in this new season here at Everyman.
Thanks.
You just heard Rebecca LaChance, a current Broadway understudy for the role of Carol King in Beautiful. Kyle Prue, Everyman Theater's Director of Production and Casting. And Joe Smelser, Shakespeare Theater Company's resident production stage manager. In conversation around Everyman Theater's current performance, The Understudy. For more information on our guests and The Understudy, visit everymantheater.org. And send us your feedback on today's shows at talk@steinershow.org. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. To hear this show again, podcast past shows, and find out information about our guests and the work they do, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And you can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. And for Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care and have a great weekend.